The Glenn Show is brought to you by the Manhattan Institute. Please consider becoming a paid subscriber at glennlowry.substack.com. As a subscriber, you will receive new episodes on Mondays instead of Fridays and get access to exclusive content, ticket pre-sales to live events, monthly Q&As with Glenn Lowry and John McWhorter, and other benefits. Your contribution will also help to fund grassroots initiatives that empower Black development across the country as we donate 10% of our profits to the Woodson Center. Thank you.
Hello, everybody. Glenn Lowry here. You are seeing me at this moment because I'm currently recovering from back surgery. I'm not able to record new episodes just now and won't be for a while. I have recorded some episodes in advance, so we'll be able to post content afresh every week at The Glenn Show. Every other week, as you know, John McWhorter and I talk. And John McWhorter will continue to appear every other week. In fact, today, John is going to be filling in for me, hosting The Glenn Show, if you like, The Glenn and John Show. I sure am looking forward to seeing what he does with the opportunity. I will be back just as soon as I can, but in the meantime, and forgive me for this, I want to remind you that my book, Late Admissions, Confessions of a Black Conservative, is available for pre-order at all major bookstores right now. The book's publication date, May 14, but you can order the book now, and I sure hope you do. This is an extremely important piece of work that I've produced in this book, important to me, and I hope it will be important to you. It gives a full accounting of my life, a long, rich, and complex life, of my successes and failures, of my professional accomplishments, my personal peccadilloes, my spiritual explorations. I try to take my own measure in this book. I try to get beneath the cover story that I have been telling myself, the cover stories about this or that escapade, and to pull back the covers. And in doing so, learn about myself, but also expose myself. Those who have looked at it, some of the reviewers say that it's an extraordinarily candid reflection on my life, and I believe that it is. It also is an opportunity for a reader to learn about my ideas, about the genesis of my doctoral dissertation, about my period as a Reagan conservative public intellectual in the 1980s, as a man of the left in the late 1990s and early aughts, and as a anti-racism terror in our current time. No, don't take that anti too seriously. But I do think some of these anti-racists have got their heads well placed up their rear ends. And I don't mind saying so. But in any case, so I've wandered around, my thought has changed. And that's reflected in the book. The story of Late Admissions encompasses my attempts to transcend my shortcomings and to find peace with myself and peace with the world. So I hope you take a look at it. Book comes out May 14th, but you will help me a great deal if you pre-order it now using one of the links in the description. Thanks a lot. So here's John McWhorter, guest hosting The Glenn Show.
Hi, folks. This is The Glenn Show. And as probably only about 2.5 of you don't know, I am not Glenn Lowry, the brown economist. I guess you could say that he was the brown economist in two ways, but he is, I should say, on the mend, and he will be back with the show soon. But I am one of his frequent guests, and I am subbing for him. I'm John McWhorter. I teach linguistics at Columbia University and write for the New York Times. And I am honored this week to have as my guest Tyler Austin Harper. He teaches at Bates up in Maine. And he has his BA from Haverford, who turned me down, or I should say, no, it was that I didn't get a financial aid form in time, but I'm supposed to have gone to Harvard. Got his PhD in comp lit at NYU. And these days he's been writing regularly for The Atlantic and also for The New York Times and some other places. And I frankly find him to be one of the most interesting figures on race and beyond, who has become prominent lately. And so, Tyler, so glad to see you, and thanks for coming
on
today. And I want to start out by asking you, what are some genuine questions of mine? You're a comp lit specialist. You have a degree in novels and such, and yet your billet at Bates is in environmental science, and apparently those two subjects have something to do with each other. Can you please explain?
Yeah, so I'm in environmental studies. We have an interdisciplinary program. So we have a couple of social scientists, now two scientists, and I'm one of two humanities people. So most of my work is on the history of the idea of human extinction and how our fears about the end of the world have changed over time. Historically, before we dropped the bomb, a lot of the early speculation about the end of the world and human extinction happened in literature. So I kind of work between literature and the history of science, thinking about how interactions between the two have sort of shaped our fears about the end of the world, from, you know, nuclear war to pandemics to climate change. So that's kind of where I fit in the environmental landscape. But I also, you know, I teach environmental film courses about, you know, when animals attack movies, and I do all sorts of other stuff. The benefit of being, you know, one of the only humanities people in a non-humanities department is that you don't have to fight for anything, you know? So if I want to teach monster movies, I can teach monster movies and no one's going to tell me no, you know? So yeah, it works out.
You were one of the only people on the market who kind of switch hit between those two subjects, I'm imagining. Like how you're surrounded by these people who are studying Joyce and, you know, Gene, Reese, et cetera. How did you come up with this particular, very interesting, although I'm sure you understand, eccentric way of looking at the subject?
Yeah, it's a good question. Ironically, I started my PhD thinking I was going to be a Joycean and do Joyce, and I'm still...
Oh, for real?
Yeah.
Oh, I just made that up.
Right. Okay. No. But at a certain point, you know, the market for Joyce and modernism and sort of high theory is the job market is very much dried up. So part of my motivation was driven by sort of, you know, thinking about like what kind of fields are marketable. But I also became interested. I had read a book about the sort of philosophical problems around human extinction. And I became interested in that. And I started digging for a history of human extinction, like the idea of it. And I couldn't find one. And in fact, there was only a very slim volume that discussed even the history of species extinction as a concept. And so, you know, it seemed to me that there was this big and actually really quite interesting gap. So I, you know, I began working on trying to piece together, you know, where did our fears about human extinction come from? How did they change over time, et cetera? But it sort of started as, you know, I wanted to do something environmental because it felt like I was A, interested in it and had been interested in environmentalism for many years. But, you know, B, it seemed like that was a field in which people could actually get jobs. And then I kind of stumbled into this problem, which was actually really fascinating.
Here's a question. From what I know, which is on this subject, as in many, pretty shallow, there is an explosion of thoughts about what the quote-unquote future is going to be like, as in, that starts late 1800s. Whereas I think we can say that George Washington wasn't thinking much about some fantastical future. If anything, he assumed it was going to be more or less the way it was then.
Yeah.
What created that sense of the future as something to speculate about human extinction, as something to think about at all, except on a religious level?
Yeah, so there was a guy named George Cuvier, who's a paleontologist and comparative anatomist, so someone who looks at the difference between different kinds of animal skeletons.
He's the one who's trying to tie it all to floods and stuff.
Yes, right? He was the catastrophist, exactly, yeah.
Right.
And so he, a lot of people don't realize this, but the idea of extinction or species loss is really new, not just human extinction, but extinction in general. There are a lot of reasons for that. One, even though we had discovered fossils hundreds and hundreds of years ago, we didn't have a theory of geological change. And for example, a lot of fossils were found on mountaintops and at high elevation, and they were of fish, right? So if you don't have a sense that the, you know, there's geological change and the earth moves, there's no way to explain
how fish... What
do you
make of that? Yeah.
Yeah. And so it was actually easier as crazy as it sounds to imagine they're just strangely shaped rocks than to think these might be the remains of extinct creatures. For various reasons, that begins to change in the late 18th century. Part of what the final nail in the coffin that proved that extinction had happened was by the late 18th century, most of the world had been explored and we had found these giant remains of mammoths and mastodons, right? That didn't match contemporary elephants. And these were creatures that were so large that surely we would see them if, you know, the world's been pretty mapped out.
One would
come
know.
Across them. One yeah. would know. And so that happens at the end of the late 1790s. Cuvier makes this great discovery. And almost, not quite overnight, but almost overnight, you know, a lot of literary figures in particular begin to think, okay, well, if this giant creature can be snuffed out, then, you know, a fragile creature like man can easily shuffle off this mortal coil. And so that's kicked off, you know, a century plus of speculation about the end of the world. And, you know, humans have worried about apocalypse forever. I mean, there has not been a generation that has not thought their generation was going to be the last,
right.
you know.
Right.
But the idea of extinction, the end of the world not caused by a divine event, mystical or otherworldly causes,
exactly. yeah.
is distinct to the 19th century. Yeah.
Right. Who's the first person who writes a novel about it? I'm thinking it's Yell, but...
Yeah, you know. Mary Shelley, actually. She wrote a novel, lesser known than Frankenstein, published in 1826 called The Last Man, which actually got a kind of renaissance during the pandemic because it imagines a global plague that wipes out the human species. A distinction I make in my work is there's a shift in the 19th century, at least in the Anglo-American context. Originally, extinction was thought as this thing about which we could do nothing. So incurable plagues, like in Shelley's novel, or comet strikes, global, you know, huge planetary scale catastrophes. And it's not until the late 19th century with people like Wells who begin to think of extinction as a problem that we could potentially solve and strategize against, right? Whether it's through traveling to other planets or longevity therapies or all these sort of you know, techno-scientific ways of preventing extinction. But the idea that not only extinction is possible, but can be prevented, that emerges kind of in the after Darwin for various reasons in the late 19th century.
Are you giving us pieces of what's going to be in the book that I see you have coming out? Because actually, yes. I have to say this carefully. I was thinking Tyler must be doing a book. I just assume, based on what I know of you, a book must be coming. And I hate to say this, but based on what my eye naturally goes to first, I thought, what thing is he going to have to say about race that is interesting? And I'm sure it'll be interesting, but I thought it's kind of hard not to say things that haven't already been said. And I thought I wouldn't want that challenge. Then it turns out that the book is about extinction. And so
actually, John, there are two. There is a race book.
Oh, there is.
My academic book's coming out through Princeton, although it'll be pretty public facing. It's
something about
it's
an animal
book, but yeah, hopefully
it's
readable.
Called Animal, the Human,
the Paranoid Animal. Yeah. Human yeah. Extinction Before the Bomb. Yep.
Right.
And then okay. I'm writing another book for Norton about, elite hiring and college admissions in the wake of affirmative action and how things have changed and also not changed. That's expanding. I had written an essay for the New York Times about AA last summer about what I called racial gamification and the way that candidates, job applicants, and particularly high school students trying to get into college have to sort of play games with their race and frame it in different ways for admissions committees. So I'm writing a book about how that's changed. And like I said, also kind of not changed after the Supreme Court decision.
Is your point in writing it to make people do things differently, or is it more an anthropological creed occur?
Mostly the latter. I mean, I really think, and I think this probably speaks to a number of things we'll discuss today, I don't necessarily have a ton of faith that higher education, elite higher education, can be reformed in ways that are meaningful. I think there are a lot of baked-in problems that are just, it's not easy to see how to dissolve them. And so, I mean, these institutions rightfully want diversity. There's limits on how they can achieve that. Now, thanks to the Supreme Court decision, no one can check a box. So the only way to signal diversity is through the college essay, which means this kind of performative discussion about race and trauma, et cetera, is now really the only avenue through which for, you know, for colleges to figure out who's diverse and for applicants to signal their diversity. And I don't think there's much that can be done about it. And so, you know, in a perfect world, if I was in charge of Yale and Harvard and everything else, I would probably have SAT cutoffs, say 1300, and everything would be a randomized lottery above that. But, you know, I am not the emperor of higher ed. So, I'm not, other than some utopian solutions like that, I don't know that there's much to be done, but I'm fascinated by it, you know, in the sort of compulsory racial performance that, not just, you know, Black and Brown students, but also white students have to go through. I mean, I worked as a college tutor for many years. And one of the things that was striking to me is that I would work with wealthy white kids who were like, look, I'm not just rich and white. My dad's an alcoholic, right? So I haven't had an easy life. Or, I'm neurodivergent or this or that, you know? And so, whereas I think racial performance and passing and code switching and all of these sort of ways of positioning identity used to be just folks of color, it's now kind of expanded to everyone. And that's one of the things I'm interested in. This kind of racial performance is compulsory across the board, whether you're white, Black, brown, yellow, or whatever.
Well, all right, let me do devil's advocate here, because I feel the same way about these things as you. I don't see how it can change. There are times when you can't get the toothpaste back in the tube, and the basic commitments of perfectly sane and benevolent people who are now running elite institutions and also just institutions of learning, I don't see how it can change. There's a whole generation that's set in, their hair is already graying, and they're going to hire people like them. But let's say I have to make up one of my characters. Her name is Monique. She's 17, and Monique is a Black girl. I'm picking, that's kind of an antique Black girl name now, but I don't want it to be too real. But Monique is writing her essay, and she's not allowed to say she's Black, but she's signaling that she's Black. It's clear that anybody reads this knows that she grew up maybe lower or middle class, and she's Black. She signals it because there's a certain kind of experience that Black people have that is uniquely unjust because of our history in this country, and possibly the feelings against Black people are more deeper or more virulent than against others. I frankly don't think so, but Monique has been taught that, and her parents probably think so, and I could be wrong. So she signals it in her essay, and that does help her get into, I'm going to pick a place at random, Vanderbilt, Rice, whatever. Mm-hmm. What's wrong with that? You're calling it a performance, and there are certain people who would bristle, but Monique may be thinking she's being a good human being in 2024, right?
Yeah. So the first thing I would say about performance, I come from the land of critical theory. And so I'm thinking about performance in the sense of, you know, that someone like Judith Butler.
Okay.
Yeah, exactly. You know, that we do all have to, in various ways, signal our identity to folks in power in ways that makes us legible. My overall take and my very strong opinion is that we shouldn't moralize about this, right? Like, I mean, we all, in various ways, particularly if you're folks of color, have to navigate the reality that people in hiring and admissions want diversity. They expect it to come in a certain kind of package, right? And that's the incentive structure. And I think if you want to, I think there's a certain kind of, you know, more conservative person who might say, well, these people are just taking advantage of their identity to get a leg up and blah, blah, blah. And that's actually not my take at all. My take is the incentive structures are bad that compel most of us to play these kinds of games. And if you want to complain about it, I don't think you should blame the individual people who are just doing their best to find opportunities where they come, like most of us. I think we should think about, like, why are these systems in place that require Black kids to feel like they have to talk about trauma in their college essay, right? Like, I think that's not on them. That's on, you know, administrators and admissions folks and other forces in universities that make the incentive structure look the way it does.
I think just like you find a megalosaurus bone in England, and it's this enormous thing, and there are no lizards walking around that big, and you're trying to figure out how things go, and we think, couldn't they figure out that things had gone extinct? But no, you really have to pull the camera back. In the same way, I think a great many people today, and not just Monique, I think just people of color and particularly this color, I think that we tend to forget how weird it is in human history for the bedrock of your racial identity and the thing that probably even almost gets your endorphins going is a sense of yourself as oppressed. The idea that that is the main thing about you and the thing that you're almost proud of that mm-hmm. you get through life despite the oppression. It's understandable where that comes from among Black people. And, oh, I know what everybody's thinking. What about Jewish people? But that's the thing. It's different. Yes, mm-hmm. there's an idea of we will never forget. There's an idea that we're constantly persecuted. But it's not the center of Jewish identity to feel that there are people who think we're inferior and we mm-hmm. just might be, and we're going to yeah. give into it a little bit. And no, the idea with Jewish people is we're not inferior. I'm not sure that Black people always know that as much, understandable why, but it's a very unusual sense of identity. And this way of writing an essay encourages that. So how do you show that you're Black? Something bad happened to you. That's, yeah. I find that unhealthy, but I don't know if it can be fixed.
I agree. Oh, I find it totally unhealthy. I find it psychologically deforming. I think it programs students to think a certain way about themselves. And it's not just Black students. No. You know, when I was at NYU, I had a student who warned me at the beginning of the semester that they are a mentally fragile person and that I should be aware of that. Right. And, you know, on the one... Yeah, and on the one hand, you know, like whatever accommodation someone has is fine. That's for someone else to decide, not me. But the what stuck with me was the way she framed it, right? It wasn't like I have XYZ condition that might make ABC things difficult for me or that I might need more time or whatever. It was like who I am is mentally fragile, you know? And I think that it's not just race. It's all yeah. sorts of other stuff where many of us are now programmed to think on a kind of deficit model, you know? And I don't think it's... I don't think it's especially healthy. It's understandable in a lot of ways. You know, I'm a big fan of the historian Christopher Lash, and he wrote a book called The Culture of Narcissism, where, you know, he made the point.
I read it last week just by chance.
Oh, nice. Yeah. I'm a big Lash fan. Keep and, going. You know, the point he makes there is like, yes, there is this narcissistic self-absorption and this wounded mentality and victim, et cetera. But it's a result of economic forces. This isn't just a cultural change. In other words, this isn't people who need to pull themselves up by their bootstraps. The world is uncertain. And in the 70s, Lash was talking about nuclear anxiety, environmental, economic anxiety, inflation, whatever. But today it's really the same. And so, you know, I think there's a certain narrative that's like these kids are snowflakes and they need to buck up. And that's not entirely wrong, right? There is a cultural dimension to everything, but then there's also this. But
they're
other
doing
piece.
It for a reason. Yeah. Calling the name doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, exactly. And universities are increasingly a rat race, and college admissions. I mean, college acceptance rates have plummeted over the last few years. It's remarkable. I mean, some institutions that, you know, I think Boston College has dropped from like in the last decade of 40 or 50% acceptance rate to a 20% acceptance rate. The school I teach at's dropped like a stone. So, you know, there are a lot of pressures on these kids. There's academic pressures. There's, you know, environmental pressures. They're worried about climate change. There's, you know, war. There's a lot of problems. So I have, even as I find, I agree with you that this orientation is really bad for people, minorities in particular. I also think it's, you know, understandable in a certain way.
Yeah, it's throughout the culture. And that's actually Lash. That book was one that I had sort of pretended to have read forever.
Yeah,
and then I realized, no, I need to actually read it. And yeah, I was good. Just thinking, I wish he were writing now because... You know, the book is now inevitably dated in terms of its references. And I was thinking that I agree with everything he's saying, or like 90% of what he's saying, except I think there's a mission creep. And you're right that now this is all over the culture. It's by no means just Black students and Black people. But there's a mission creep, I think, from the civil rights movement, where it starts with activism. You want to go change the world. But there's also a sense of purpose and a certain sense of fellowship that you get when you are engaging in activism. And when the more concrete things are finished, when you've got a Civil Rights Act of 1964, you've got the Fair Housing Act, so you don't have the apartheid that there used to be. Once that happens, you might still want to keep going. There's a part of humanity that likes feeling united against an enemy. That's probably cooked into us because of, you know, our deep past. And I think that that mission creep starts in the 70s, and I think that then other groups look to Black people and model their sense of identity on this idea of being a victim. And it's not that people are snowflakes. It's not that people are manipulative. Yeah. There's no such thing as a poverty pimp. It's all of us are atoms caught up in all of this. But
yeah,
no one can be blamed. But we live in a weird time. In a way, I understand this less than I understand what was going on 50 years ago. But Tyler, I wanted to ask you, so 1300 cutoff. What, like, and it's the Tyler University. What happens if there really aren't very many brown people other than South Asians above the 1300 cutoff? Because let's face it, especially at about 25 schools, that might be the case. What do we do about that?
I mean, you know, if I were in charge, I would probably mandate, I don't know what the percentage would be, but I would probably, you know, think it's reasonable to say the school shouldn't be more than XYZ percent of one single population, you know? And so, I mean, again, I think a lot of the problem is downstream from, you know, Richard Hanania, who is a loathsome creature in a number of ways, but wrote a book called The Origins of Woke that was about sort of partly the history of the Civil Rights Act. And one of the things, as unfortunate as I find him, that he said in that book that I think is a really good point, is he said, what people don't realize is the Civil Rights Act was a compromise position. You had folks on the left that wanted quotas, right? And they wanted affirmative action as quotas, where the American population is, say, 13% Black. A minimum 13% of your admissions class needs to be Black, or your workforce or whatever. And then the right wanted nothing, right? They didn't want affirmative action. They didn't want anything. And the compromise position became this middle ground where you had to show that you were at least trying to recruit, you know, students of color, or trying to recruit a diverse workforce. And that's what expanded the bureaucracy. You didn't actually have to achieve it, right? You didn't have to be able to show, like, look, we are 13% Black. But you needed to be able to show the government, if you wanted government funding, here are these initiatives, right? And so that actually incentivized bureaucracy that didn't necessarily need to solve things, but did need to prove that, hey, look, we're trying in all of these ways. And we've added 50 personnel to our, you know, XYZ commission since last year. And so my point is, you know, in a perfect world, I think quotas, are roughly fine, like not in like a granular way. But I think if you want to say, like, you know, the universe, America's diverse, you know, increasingly we don't have one single majority. We shouldn't have one single majority of any race in college admissions. I think that's fine. And so I think if you want to introduce, you know, some nuance in a perfect world, that'd be great. We can't do that, though, obviously, with the Supreme Court. So I think some kind of cutoff. And I think you could make a case for, you know, maybe it's 1200, maybe it's 1300. Obviously, it would be need to be different from school to school. I think that's fine. But, you know, I mean, the other thing I would say to your rejoinder, OK, but what if there are not enough Black kids? I mean, this has been the case at University of California, Berkeley, since California outlawed affirmative action. The number of Black students have dropped. My understanding is those students have went to other universities in the California school system.
I was there.
Actually, yep. done better, are more mm-hmm. likely to graduate in the top half of their class, and in many cases are put on a better trajectory than they would be otherwise.
That you is know? What happened.
Yeah. And I mean, again, if I were king, I think institutions like Harvard, Yale, et cetera, sitting on these extremely lucrative endowments that pay very little taxes and in fact are kind of have a predatory relationship to the surrounding community, where places like New Haven is, there's plenty of poverty in New Haven and Yale is not contributing to a lot of the taxes. You know, I think these universities should be required to put more money into schools in their area. It would be great if they pumped more money into high schools and, you know, inner city areas, and also did more recruiting. You know, I mean, a huge problem for the book I'm writing, I've been talking to a lot of what are called IECs, or independent education consultants. And a huge problem is just that so many minority students who are talented don't even know to apply to places like Harvard and Yale. So there are Black kids in Chicago that are getting great scores on their SATs that it would never occur to them.
They'd never dream.
They never dream about it, you know? And so I think there's, I think it's not just as cut and dried as saying, you know, we wouldn't be able to get any Black and brown kids, you know, if we had XYZ cutoff. I think, you know, more of the burden needs to be on some of these universities that have ungodly amounts of money to, you know, think more expansively about how you, you know, recruit students.
You know, that, that fact, which mm-hmm. is that the horrible thing that the change in racial preferences procedures at UC was supposed to be. And I was a young professor right in the middle of that, listening to all the rhetoric. I didn't have an official position yet. I wasn't mm-hmm. as politicized. I was trying so hard to be on the side of the quote unquote good people. I tried mm-hmm. so hard, but I found that they just weren't making any sense, especially when they were talking about the resegregation. And yeah, the kids who would have gotten into Berkeley or UCLA in 1995 went to such horrible institutions as UC Santa Cruz and UC San Diego, and they did great. And yeah. tried to share that with some people, and it's met sometimes with the most hard-bitten contempt. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there have been studies, such as by the economist Peter Archidiakono, who I think Glenn has had on this show. There's been one attempt that I know at refutation, a very, you know, good-spirited, intelligent attempt. I'm not going to name who it was, but I frankly don't think it went through, and I explained why when I was doing a Substack. And I've been in touch with him, and I think he and I just politely disagree. But my point is that if there are supposedly, quote-unquote, not enough Black students at Berkeley and UCLA now. Apparently there were enough in 1995. Now there's just not enough. The idea is that one idea is that there isn't enough opportunity, that you get this top level of opportunity at Berkeley that you don't get at UCSD, which I think would surprise many of the people working for UCSD, and it's never talked about. But more to the point, you just have to have more diversity. Tyler, do you believe that diversity, and there are many arguments for these things, but is diversity key to a good education, which we're often told? Because I don't get the data on that. I mean, there are various reasons that you would have preferences of various kinds, and I have never been anti-affirmative action in itself. Mm-hmm. But we must have a diverse class. It must reflect the, you know, the basic conception of the United States. Why exactly? And of course, you're probably aware of that one study or the one and a half studies where if people are engaged in a certain, very specific kind of activity, that a certain kind of diversity can help a little, although that diversity is not about whether mm-hmm. some people are Black American. But it's not enough. Mm-hmm. What do we say the value of diversity is in itself to an education? Or is that not really the most useful argument to make, which frankly I have come to think?
Yeah, I mean, I think the way we talk about diversity is a function of how the Supreme Court has allowed us to talk about diversity, which is that, diversity is, you know, there's this instrumental case that actually it's good for the learning of everyone to have a diverse.
Right. Whatever. The Backe decision, right.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, my point of view is that it has cultivated a really, for lack of a non-academic term, like this kind of extractivist way of thinking about diversity, which is that Black people and brown people are there to educate culturally the white majority campus, right?
Yeah.
And that's kind of that is the assumption that underlays this, right? Because the white kids are not providing the diversity of cultural experiences, right? That's not what
it's assumed that we already know what they're like, right?
Yeah. And so like people like look like you and I essentially are supposed to have this pedagogical function at universities where we're supposed to teach the nice white kids, you know, about the, you know, kumbaya and the importance of whatever. And I find that to be an offensive kind of argument. Now, that's the argument that gets made. That's how we talk about diversity now. Now, if you want to talk about affirmative action as a redress to decades of systematic exclusion of Black people from all sorts of structures in society, I think that's totally reasonable. I am fine with that particular case. And I think that's how the public often thinks about affirmative action, right? That, oh, it's about systematic redress. But again, the university position on affirmative action is really actually about this like diversity pedagogy question or learning about, you know, other cultures, et cetera, through the experience of being in a diverse climate. Diversity is great. I like teaching at a school that's diverse. It's fascinating. I meet all kinds of people. But, you know, I think, again, the price of that, or perhaps not the price of that directly, but the subtext of the decisions that lead to that is actually, I think, a kind of gross one. So to me, it's more about how the problem I have is not with diversity itself. I think diversity is great, but it's like the way we think about diversity is really quite toxic, it seems to me.
Oh, yeah. If I had to teach classes where everybody was like at Columbia, if you could go back in time, mm-hmm. everybody is a white kid who grew up in Scarsdale, except for a few. It would be dull. And I do think that in discussion classes, things would be less useful. But the diversity that I found, and I didn't realize until about 10 minutes ago, I've been teaching for 30 years. I don't know when it happened that I became elderly, but I've been doing it for 30 years. And I would say that it's class, it's socioeconomic diversity that makes for the most interesting discussions, because those are the tensions that apply most to general subjects. And often the sorts of things where you think it's a Black student who would have said it, it was also a less privileged white person or a white person who understands about race issues and is sympathetic, who might even speak up for that point when the Black student, as often as not, in my experience, doesn't want to be the black voice in the class that we're doing about race issues. And I've had some of them tell me, please don't call on me more than everybody else today. And that's exactly how I felt when I was in college. And so, and the thing is, everybody is talking about, well, you have to learn, you know, what the diversity is. You have to be around black people. And yet none of them would want to look one of their black admits in the face and say that that was one of the reasons they were supposed to be there. Totally. And I have sometimes asked some people in that position, what is it about black kids that you want them to learn, especially since we're really talking about middle class black kids who grew up rather like everybody
else.
It's
not upper class.
And I have never gotten a coherent answer. It's just this mantra that people have learned to recite. And yeah, a lot of that is the Bakke decision in 78, which is an overly ambitious reading of what I think Justice Powell meant almost as a sidebar, but it became this shibboleth. Yeah, yeah, this stuff is hard. You didn't like being called being the black person in class? I hated that.
Oh, no. Yeah, not at all. I definitely have students. I've had students where I teach now. I've had students at NYU who I can tell don't like it either. You know, I think as ornery as I am about, quote unquote wokeness, I think a lot of people would be surprised. My syllabi are very diverse because I teach things that I think are interesting and they happen to be pretty diverse. But I definitely see, you know, they're not to be so reductive, but there tend to be kind of two sorts of black students you encounter. One who's very eager to share their personal experience and talk. You know, if I teach a black poetry collection, I teach Camille T. Dungy, who's a environmental poet who's black and she's great. And I always have some students who are really excited to talk about, you know, the way it resonates with them personally. And then I have other students you can see just shrinking into their chair and they don't want to be called on, you know. And I felt that way, too. I took I had an African-American lit class that was taught by a wonderful, wonderful professor and novelist. She's fantastic. And it was a great class. But through no fault of hers, she was a black woman, through no fault of hers, I hated being in that class, right? Because anytime something would come up, you'd see, I was the only black kid and you'd see the eyes, you know,
everybody's like, looking at
you. Yeah. It sucks, you know, and some people like that. And I think that's, aren't bothered by that. I think that is fine. I was not one of them, you know? And so, I just think there's not, colleges leave a lot of room for the first kind of black kid and not a lot of room for the second kind, often in the way, you know, courses and everything else are designed and discussed, et cetera. So, yeah, I mean, I have a lot of sympathy for that. That was sort of my perspective when I was an undergrad.
I know what you mean about those two types. And I would say that actually there are fewer of the first than of the second. And it's not that they don't have a strong racial identity. It's not that they're not interested. Oh, yeah. But, you know, suppose they don't feel like they have anything particularly brilliant to say that day about that piece. Suppose they're kind of shy. And yet there you go. You've got this responsibility. And so, that's a hard thing. And yet no administrator, whatever color they are, is allowed to confront how fake that idea is of what the value of diversity is supposed to be. What is, if I may, how diverse is Bates? Given that we're kind of way up there.
And so pretty diverse. Actually, we do a fairly good job. Particularly
recruiting.
We do. Oh. And I think we also, I will say, do a good job of thinking about diversity a little more capaciously than some other institutions I've been at, both in terms of class, but also in terms of, I mean, Maine is very white and it is up north very poor. We definitely do a good job, I feel like, of bringing in students from other parts of Maine and counting, thinking about that as like diversity. We also have a pretty good job with transfer students from community colleges and other sorts of places, military vets. So, you know, there is, I think, at any institution, a hard limit, and this is just part of the reality, of how much socioeconomic diversity and racial diversity you can have, depending on what your budget is, right? So, and Bates is very rich by the standards of many colleges, by the standards of some of our peers like Bowdoin and Colby. We're not as wealthy as them, right? And so there's a limit as to how many students who are poor and who are disproportionately minority that we can take. But I think we do a pretty good job within the bounds of what is financially possible.
I went on this dream vacation to Maine in another time now, so maybe things are different, but it was 1975, and we were on an island, and if for weird reasons, my should I out people involved? Yeah, they're all gone. My grandmother was the seamstress for the Lee of Lee and Perrin's steak sauce. And they were a very, very rich family. And they would do this favor to their staff every year. And we would get to be on this island. And the people who worked, they're all gone. The people who worked on the island were local whites. Mm-hmm. I got the feeling for them, black was not a category. There were no black people around. They probably, all of them met 10 in their lives, and we were probably four or five of them. But when they had had a little beer, the way they talked about the local Native Americans sounded just like black people were talked about in the South. It was weird, and they would even do it within our earshot. So I thought, I think now, well, I guess there was some serious oppression of Native Americans, and of course there was. Is there a Native American presence at Bates, and how does that play out today?
Yeah, that's a fraught question. And it's a hard one. And I think we have, I think we do have some Native students, but not as many as I know the administration.
Not a visible population.
Yes. Okay. And I think that's, it's not a simple matter of not recruiting or wanting folks from that population. We have the Wabanaki, the Penobscot in Maine. And I also think there are like trust issues that are historical that, you know, are
understandable. You know,
very understandable. So I think there are a lot of complicated reasons as to why that is the case that don't reduce down narrowly to just, you know, recruitment failure. But I think more broadly, you know, the question about indigeneity in Maine and racism in Maine is a really interesting one. I think at least in terms of like, you know, and Maine has gotten more diverse, and I'm in Southern Maine around Portland, which is very diverse. But you know, I think you're right where like there's kind of not a racial consciousness in Maine because it's so white. And so, like, I remember one of my first days on campus at Bates, I, you know, had to go to some thing with minority faculty. And, you know, there was some, you know, senior minority faculty member giving us advice. And they were like, you know, in my experience, you know, someone was like, well, there's all this great outdoors and recreation. And, you know, do I need to be worried going hiking about, you know, like mountain races or something? And she's like, no, I mean, you're just going to be confused as to why you're there. You know, it's just like black people are a curiosity. They're not, you know, they're not in Maine. There's not like this sort of racialized culture.
There aren't
like,
any.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, and that's been like largely my experience. I do a lot of fishing. You know, I mostly fish at night for reasons that are particular to the kind of fish I fish for. So I am out in the middle of nowhere.
Fish for striped bass. I'm sorry, but I need to know this. What fish?
Yeah. So I fish for striped bass, which are not nocturnal, but large striped bass are nocturnal. And they come particularly into shore at night to feed under the cover of darkness. So, and so I mostly, I catch and release everything, but I'm sort of a trophy hunting mindset. So I'm mostly fishing for big fish. And so
The island, we were hunting for salmon, I seem to remember, and some other kind of fish. And we caught a lot. And frankly, it was 1975. We ate them. And that was a lot of fun. But anyway, go ahead.
No. So, but you know, so I fish like 80 days a year, nights a year. And so I interact with the police a lot. By virtue of that, you know, if you're out in the middle of nowhere and, you know, you're in a parking lot or whatever, getting ready to go fish, cops always want to know what you're doing. And they're all, and other folks, they're always nice. They're always like, oh, what are you doing out here? And I'm like, oh, I'm
fishing.
You
don't have the story to tell, in other words.
No. Oh, no, not at all. I mean, I would probably say, I don't know, two or three times a month I interact with the cops. And no, and it's usually different ones. I fish all up and down. I travel a lot to fish all up and down the coast of Maine. And no, I've never had anything even in the ballpark of a negative experience. In fact, a number of the places I fish, I would describe as quasi-legal in the, you know, where you're not supposed to be there after dark, but, you know, you can park down the road and walk in. And you know, cops will show up. They're like, and you know, you'll see them harassing teenagers or whatever that are there. And then they're like, what are you doing? You're like, oh, I'm fishing. And they're like, all right, get out of here. You know, go have fun, you know? So no, I found it a very, very hospitable state.
Don't you want to, I don't know the rules on this, but you catch this nice big bass. Mm-hmm. Don't you want to take one home and consume it? Is that wrong now?
No, well, I mean, so there are a couple things. One, their numbers are declining. They're not close to endangered, but they're declining. And so there's a very narrow, you can only keep striped bass from 28 to 31 inches. Mm. And I am targeting fish sort of in the north of 40 inch range. And so I'm not, mostly what I'm shooting for is well above what you can keep anyway. The other thing is they spawn in the Chesapeake Bay. So they're a fish that migrates. And the Chesapeake Bay is full of chemicals and lead and PFAS. And so they actually have tons of mercury.
You don't want to eat it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, they're delicious. And, you know, probably once or twice a year, I'll have a fish that is in that legal limit that, you know, they swallow a lure or they're not going to make it. And so I'll keep one a year. But no, I mostly let them go. They're also, the kind of fishing I do often involves wading very far out, or even in some cases swimming. You use a wetsuit to rocks that are offshore. And if you catch a fish on a rock and then need to swim it or wade very far back, the whole thing is a pain. So there are a bunch of logistical and conservation and other reasons why I just let them go on their way.
I get it. People don't know I collect insects, and apparently
I did not know that. That's awesome.
It is. That's cool. Apparently. Yeah, back to the 70s, you put them on a pin and you put them in a box. A lot of people now are appalled that I would do this, you know, even if I take them into a different world in humane fashion. You're supposed to catch it and take a picture of it and let it go. I'm trying to wrap my head around doing that because it doesn't feel right unless I get it on display. But I guess that makes me a three-named guy with a big mustache. I don't know.
No. That's really cool. We had to do that in, I took a Bio 2 class taught by this amazing biologist in high school who was like really into, you know, all manner of critters. Yeah. So he did, we had to do the sort of pinning of the insects.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was cool.
Yeah. Oh, I've got a big collection. Tyler, I wanted to ask you something else. And this is a real question I always have about you watching on social media. And I don't mean that I don't mean it as a put down.
No, sure.
I just think he is diverse from me in this. Yeah. You clearly, you know, read a book a day. You've got real classes you're teaching. You're out at night catching bass. And yet, you are on X all day. You are on there, and forgive me if I'm mischaracterizing, you've got something on there all the time. You clearly are doing that a lot. And it's all very intelligent. It's interesting. You're on there fighting with people, and you're doing that. Why? Like, for me, it's always, I just want to curl up with the book, and then I'm going to go make some lunch. And I peek in on Twitter. I look two or three times a day, but I don't participate a whole lot because I just figure, there's all that anger and I've got other stuff to do. What do you find so attractive about it? That's my genuine question.
I actually find it useful for writing. I, you know, will often float ideas or takes or things I'm thinking and see what the response is. And not like, I don't mean that in like an intentionally provocative way, but like, you know, like, for example, I wrote an article sort of criticizing the media's fascination with polyamory. And I had, there was a New York Magazine special issue on polyamory. And I read it and I just found it both stupid and in various ways abhorrent.
You did,
And so, you know, I tweeted about it got a lot of both like people really interested and also critical. And it's helpful, right? Like to see like, okay, this is actually something that people do find interesting. Here are the kinds of objections I'm getting. So in some cases I'm like, well, I think these people are idiots and I'm going to ignore their objections. But in other cases, I'm like, actually that's a pretty thoughtful point. And so then if I end up writing about it, you know, it's kind of early feedback. And that's how, I mean, and obviously, you know, there are plenty of things I tweet about that I have no intention of writing about, but I do find it, as awful as I find Elon Musk and as toxic as I find Twitter, I do find it useful for that particular reason. It's kind of a workshop where I can float some things that I'm maybe interested in writing about.
It's a very useful public square. And it's at the point where if you don't halfway know what's going on there, you can barely be a writer. Yeah, that's definitely true. But there's a part of me that just think, well, it's the time sink in that once you start, you can't get out of there. And sometimes I'm thinking, I've been reading this stuff for 45 minutes and, you know, Culture of Narcissism is still sitting on my to read shelf. Wondered how you felt about that, you know. But I wanted also to ask, what will you be doing in 5 years, do you think? What's your game plan? Or do you not think that way?
No, I do. I mean, I definitely still, I genuinely like teaching. I get a lot out of it. I, you know, like many of us, I wish I taught a little less than I do. But I like teaching. I like students. Yeah, who doesn't? Exactly. You know, and so I definitely, you know, intend to stay in academia. I think it provides a lot. I mean, also the market for writing's really, you know, it's not as you well know. I mean, there's a vanishing number of opportunities. It's increasingly unstable, you know, and so I want to keep writing. I think, once I've done, this academic book and maybe another one, I probably will focus primarily on public facing stuff. I work in areas that, one of the reasons I started doing more writing for the public is that I work in areas that are, I think, topical. I work on human extinction. We're in a moment of a lot of anxiety about the end of the world, whether it's from, the renewed Cold War or a pandemic or climate change or whatever.
We're extinct.
And there's something really unsatisfying to me, and irresponsible might be too strong a point on it, but I do think like academia should be a space for people to explore esoteric and niche things if that is what they do. But I also think sometimes the incentive structure of academia, and particularly in the humanities fields, the just like jargon riddled esotericism that is often not based in utility, but that is just like how style, I think, is really unfortunate, because it pushes people to publish work that's actually really important and interesting and of public interest in obscure venues. And even when it's not in obscure venues,
you don't know what the hell they're saying. Yeah.
Exactly.
Unless you're one of 500 people. Yeah.
Yeah. And so particularly given, I do stuff in the environmental space. I do think the public side of things is very important to me, even when I'm not always necessarily talking about, things that are directly out of my academic focus. But I definitely don't want to write any less than I am. But I do want to keep teaching.
Yeah. I had a Humanities Center fellowship at Stanford back in 1991. And I was a little out of place, partly because it was they were wonderful people, all of them absolutely brilliant, but there were a lot of, it was that first wave of people who wrote like Judith Butler and talked to each other like Judith Butler. Yeah. And I thought, these people are engaged with the world. They are as upset about what's happening in Iraq as I am. But when they do their academic work, they're writing it in what might as well be Polish. They're speaking to each other with these words that no one understands. All of it rather passionless. Suddenly, these people who are very excited and red hot people in real life are talking like computers. And I just thought, it's a shame that they're turning away from the world in order to engage in a kind of group consciousness where they use words like topoi and that usage of the word performative, et cetera. Yeah, yeah. And so I just came away from it thinking, wow, I have a nostalgia for an academia I didn't know, where no one wrote that way. Imagine if Richard Hofstadter wrote that way. And this is all a very old argument. But you're saying that because of that, you would rather be public facing. You're not gonna go become a dean.
God, no. The insult. I feel like I spend a fair amount of my chunk of public life complaining about the administrative class within universities. And yet I get this all the time, and I'm not accusing you of this, but people say, this guy's angling to be a dean. I'm like, I just wrote 3,000 words saying deans are the problems with everything. What are you talking about? No, I'm not angling to be a dean.
So you're not. Good.
Oh, no. Okay. Oh, my God. No, I'd rather eat glass. No, thank you. definitely not.
I am relieved to hear that.
Yeah, I agree with you about the jargon point. Humanities is a field like any other that has technical terms and has a right to them. And I think that's
always
fine.
Will.
But I do think there's a boundary between like, here are the necessary technical terms for our field, and then here's what has become house style for no other reasons than house style. And I do think also the mystification and jargon lets bad ideas seep through. As an example, one of the moments where I became done, I was I still read a lot of theory, but I was really into French theory in my PhD. And the moment where I kind of like, I'm moving in a different direction was that I was reading an essay by Derrida, who in many ways is great, and I like a lot of his early work, but he had written an essay in the 80s about nuclear war. And in that essay, he says, this is, I think, a direct quote, nuclear war is a fabulously textual experience. And I was like, this is the dumbest thing I've ever heard. Surely what a philosopher of your stature has to say about nuclear war needs to go beyond saying that it's like, thinking about it as a text, right? Like that's just, and so I kind of threw up my hands and I was like, I need a, this is not what I want to be doing,
That makes perfect sense. Do you sense that there's a turn away from that kind of perspective mm-hmm. among people in that academic world? Or do I just wish there was a turn away? Or is there maybe a turning away because the market will no longer support it the way it used to in terms of getting a job?
I think there are a few things. I think a lot of people have realized it's kind of intellectually shallow. I think there's a market question, absolutely. I think where people are, particularly as the market has, you know, previously people that went to programs like, you know, Harvard and NYU or wherever were going to end up in jobs at places like Harvard and NYU. And now, you know, I mean, I love teaching at Bates, so it's not a dig on Bates, but now there are more folks that went to sort of prestigious PhD programs that would have been focused on research universities are now at places like liberal arts colleges, satellite schools of state campuses, et cetera, where there's more of a focus on teaching. And I think as the job market has expanded, even as it's contracting in terms of numbers, but as, you know, there are more people that are, you know, like, I'm going to liberal arts colleges, or I'm, you know, I'm going to be at a state school where there's less of a research focus. Being able to communicate ideas clearly, I think, has become more of a currency, you know? And so I think part of the reason we've seen this shift is one, like, intellectual currents have changed. And I do think you're right that there's more, I see better and better writing in the humanities and more Good. People navigating, you know, like thinking clearly and even like navigating that, as they call it, the sort of crossover space between academia and public writing. But yeah. I do think part of it is like job market pressure. You know, I mean, I would have never gotten the job I got if I had just shown up and blathered about, you know, I really like, you know, the psychoanalyst Jack LaCan. If I would have blathered about, like, there's no way I would have gotten a job because they'd be like, what the hell Good. Are our students supposed to do with this? You know,
right.
But if you can go up and say, hey, you guys are worried about like climate change and this and that, there's this rich, deep history about it. I can explain it to you clearly and how it connects together. Right. Then that becomes much more, it's an easier sell, you know? So I think it is a lot of factors, but I am, even as I'm not optimistic about the macro trajectory of the humanities at the level of like funding and so on, I do think there are some healthy currents that are you know getting moving away from obscurantism.
Thank God. Tyler, this has been fun. I have wanted
Absolutely.
To do a one-on-one
a pleasure.
With you for a long time. I really hope that we can talk again soon. Your life, yeah. frankly, sounds in many ways like paradise, except that you're out on the water at night ever.
No. Yeah. It's paradise to me. I like it.
You
know
like
other
it.
People. And yeah, it's great.
No, that is rich. But let's keep in touch.
Absolutely.
And I wish you the very best of luck, including on X and at the Atlantic and everywhere else where you face outward.
Oh, thank you, John. It's been really fun. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Tyler.